everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and happy end of summer, everyone. That means it's time for our annual takedown of the summer that was 2015. So I am joined by JB.
I think I speak for the entire platoon when I suggest that we postpone this until we're better rested.
And Adam Riske.
The boys of summer are back, and when I say boys of summer, I mean the three dirty old men who hang out by the pool.
That's us!
Those are the three dirty old men who hang out in my basement.
I can't say for sure that this is the earliest we've ever recorded a podcast. I don't know.
I was thinking about that, yeah. And I believe you and Doug...
We did it, like, in the middle of the night.
Podcasting yeah. through the evening.
So that counts, technically.
That we're second best.
This is early. We had to squeeze this in for you nice people.
It's a busy time.
Speaking of Doug, we miss you, Doug. Doug used to join us on these shows, and then he died. But we are here. We miss Doug so much. So we're going to talk about the summer. We've done this now since, I think, 2010. And we just kind of talk about the summer that was.
And the summers just keep getting better.
I
thought this one was good.
I did. When I sat down, and looked at the list last night, this has been a good summer.
Then Jesus take the wheel, because I was thinking about it this morning, and I'm just so painfully... indifferent, and I wonder if it's just a function of doing this show now for 5 years in a row. What can I say about the summer that's different from summers before?
There were better summers, but at some point during the podcast, and this is really all I have to add this morning, gentlemen, you guys talk amongst yourselves.
Not a problem.
I have this weird theory about summer movies that I think bears some weight. But looking at what I saw this summer, and it was sizable, he said, holding up the list, and this is all in a theater.
It's a crisp piece of paper.
It's not, ooh, theater of the mind.
Mm-hmm. That sounded like thunder.
It's not VOD. I could come up with a 10 best list for the year with just the summer.
For real?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because...
standards are lax.
No. My standards are not lax.
I've for never instance, been accused of having lax standards.
Today is the day.
Especially on the record.
There's medication for that. Yeah.
A summer in a band called Lax Standards, by the way.
I don't know why that was so funny, but okay. It was.
This is just a taste. You know, you don't think there's 10, but actually there's more than 10. Because this summer included Mad Max Fury Road,
sure.
Which I think we'll agree is just...
It's the tops.
It's the Tower of Pisa, and also Inside Out, which I felt came out and everyone loved it and realized how ambitious it was, and then the conversation stopped.
That's every movie!
Yeah. Except Jurassic World.
Nothing can live on because the next thing is coming.
And that's...
Or the thing 5 years from now is coming. Like, we're already talking about, wow, Pixar announced Toy Story 4. Guys, they have a theater. They have a movie in theaters right now. We could talk about that. Mm-hmm. No. Let's talk about the one that they haven't started animating yet.
And at some point...
I was going to say drawing, but I realized that was out of date.
At some point this summer, you were bemoaning the fact that Inside Out, which is... ambitious and incredibly good for any number of reasons, was going to be overshadowed monetarily by Minions, which seemed to be a cash grab that didn't involve a whole lot of anything.
I think Inside Out ended up grossing more than Minions, at least so far.
And I went to Box Office Mojo because I was curious about this.
Yeah.
And Inside Out grossed more than Minions. However... And this is my wife's theory, and I think she's right. When one of these kids' CGI movies comes out, one of these CGI animated films come out, and you don't really see that it's very popular, and then the sequel comes out, like Hotel Transylvania 2, my wife has this theory that, A, they sign the voice talent to a contract that says, if this hits, you have to do the sequel. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, someone's going to be a prima donna and ask for a raise. And
Friends
because,
cast.
Exactly. And because of the nature of the film, all the previs and the character design and a lot of the nuts and bolts animation stuff has been done.
Mm-hmm.
So she thinks a lot of these unnecessary sequels are made, just because if the original one costs X, you can make the second one a lot cheaper because the heavy lifting has been done in terms of the animation work.
Maybe. I don't know. I wonder how much of it has to do, too, with numbers that we are not privy to, not necessarily worldwide stuff, but think about how many of these animated films make a lot of money at home on Blu-ray and streaming all, you know what I mean? Like,
because kids like to watch things over and over.
Right.
The thing I discovered on Box Office Mojo, though, however, was however much they made, and even though Inside Out did better, it was relatively close. Minions cost $75 million to make.
Mm-hmm.
Inside Out cost $175 million
to make. I will never understand how animated films cost so much
money. Here's what I think. When you're sitting through the end credits...
They've got the best crayons.
they contacted a very special company.
They have the box with 66 colors.
And two sharpeners.
Ooh.
Because you need a backup.
Yeah. That's what those holes were for?
That's it.
I love art. I loved it so much that I needed to fuck it.
Well, now you're just
stepping on the joke.
You're just admitting how small you are. That hole was...
I cut it bigger.
And then cut up your thing, because there's a blade in there to sharpen the crayon. Yeah.
He's got a sharp dick.
And a sharp wit.
Used to be a Sony dick.
Especially in terms of Pixar movies, the gestation period is so long. I mean, years and years, and they play with the story and stuff, and sometimes they go off in the wrong direction, they come back. If you look at the end credits, all those people are under contract. So we're talking about all the animators working for 5 years. Or they're playing a game where everything under the sun is being charged to the film for some accounting reason.
It's amazing to me.
All I'm saying is, any summer with Mad Max Fury Road and Inside Out could not be a bad summer. And it's not just those two.
I don't mean to suggest it's a bad summer. I think, and there were enough kind of big blockbuster mainstream type movies that I liked, which is to say five, maybe, I don't know, maybe not even, to justify. I mean, that's probably good. That's probably average. I'm sure most summers I could point to and say, like, yeah, that's about right. I found myself, most of the things that I liked that came out over the last couple months, I think would kind of fall under the category of more like counter-programming. Like, it was smaller. So it's not stuff you would call a summer movie.
And I'm trying to find an example of that off my list. Of the counter-programming movie.
I got one. Slow West.
Sure, there's one.
Which I haven't seen yet. I have.
Let's talk about only that.
I should have gone to the
screening. I can do a show on that. Can I rewatch it first?
The screening was on Sunday at the Music Box. You had messaged me after it was over that it was really good. It's on the shelf. I haven't seen it. Would Magic Mike XL be an example of counter-programming?
No, that's a studio movie. And that's one that I liked, right? I mean, I didn't love it. I think I still liked the first one better, but I liked it.
I didn't see it yet. I really want to, but it seemed to be in and out of theaters quicker than I expected it to be. But I think that has to do with, I don't know, just a lot of front-loading. Like, the people who wanted to see it saw it in the first couple of days, and then it just sort of didn't sustain that level of business after that. But I was surprised. It was kind of... It started in July, and it was out of theaters by end of the month.
Yeah. And it didn't have the narrative of the first movie, which is like, oh my gosh, surprise, guys. This is really good. And then people are recommending it to other people, whereas this is like, I went in expecting this, it was this, and I'm done with it.
Yeah.
So let's go all the way back.
Yeah.
It is amazing to me that this summer started, as we were saying before we press record, with Avengers Age of Ultron, because I feel like that movie came out 2 years ago.
Yep. Oh, for sure. Yeah. It wasn't... To kind of split the narrative a little bit, like, I felt like this was a pretty weak summer overall for superhero movies, between Ultron and Fantastic Four and Ant-Man.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And is that the films themselves? Because I'm capable of enjoying a superhero movie as much as the rest of anyone. But there's been too goddamn many.
There has. I think I have a pretty low bar when it comes to superhero movies. I just want to be entertained. I don't have stock in the IPs, so it's not going to upset me if they're not doing right by the characters or the storylines that have been put in the comic books. But I just thought Ultron was just kind of ponderous and just really long. And the thing that really bothered me, the thing that sticks out in my head about Ultron was really redundant action sequences in like third world countries. And I've got nothing against third world countries, but I just, if you have all the
you budget, fight America, damn it.
Yeah, exactly. If you have all the budget in the world, do what you did at the end of the Avengers and shoot it in New York or something that's kind of scenic and cool to look at in the background, not Asmanistan from the Expendables 3.
The Marvel structure, the Marvel formula, mm-hmm. I felt was really sort of showing through on Ultron, that thing that made the director say it's very difficult to work for Marvel. Because as I said when the movie came out, and I may be wrong, but this is just my opinion, I thought the best scene in the whole movie was when all of them try the hammer.
Yeah.
And that wasn't in some foreign country, and it wasn't dark, and it really involved few, if any, special effects. Because I'm interested in what it would be like to be a superhero. But it seems to me, and this harkens back to when Adam and I, after that horrible Godzilla reboot came out, that the two of us went to G-Fest, and the consensus was they loved the new Godzilla because it had Godzilla in it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my objection was not nearly enough. It's on cable now.
A lot. Yeah.
And I have since rewatched pieces of it and patted myself on the back that we were right. And for some reason, in my mind, my memory of the shot that everyone agrees is the greatest shot in the film, and if the whole film could have been as good, was reversed. When I got to it on cable, it was the other way around.
That's weird.
I remembered it with Godzilla on the left and the recipient on the right, but it's the other way around.
Weren't you watching the whole movie in a mirror, though? You were turned around, looking behind you.
I'm such a peeping Tom that I have to pretend that I'm watching the movie through a keyhole. That in Avengers, I feel the majority of the American public goes to see it, and they like it because the Avengers were in it.
Well, sure.
I'm not somebody who usually goes to bat for Joss Whedon, but with all the stories out about how Marvel kind of constricts its filmmakers and it's more of like producers' movies, I really kind of felt for him with that one because it felt like a tired man's movie. It felt like a guy who didn't want to be making the movie that he was making, except for scenes like you pointed out where they're all trying to lift the hammer or they're just around shooting the shit. Those are like the best of Joss Whedon type moments, but it just really, I'm kind of happy that the Infinity War movies are going to be the Russo brothers because maybe they'll be energetic and kind of wanting to make their stamp similar to what they did with Winter Soldier.
And Patrick is famous for saying that this is a movie that's fighting with itself for what it wants to be, Bridesmaids being the original example. And I agree with you 100% because I didn't even feel Avengers was a movie fighting with itself for what it wanted to be. I felt Avengers was a movie that had given up.
It reminded me, the one that I point to is Iron Man 2, which suffered from so many of the same problems. They were kind of Marvel problems, which is like, we have to do all this table setting, we have to introduce all this stuff, and it that's the movie that beat Jon Favreau, just like this is the movie that kind of beat Joss Whedon, that it just is kind of confused and muddled, and like you said, tired and frustrated. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't really thought about it since it came out. And again, Mike is so famous for saying that thing, like if you told me when I was 10 years old that all these movies would be coming out and I would just be exhausted, I would think you were crazy. But that's, the sequel to the Avengers came, all these characters on screen in the same movie in this summer, and I have not thought about it.
But then the corollary to that is the famous Patton Oswalt routine, where you say to a big Star Wars fan, would you like to see Darth Vader when he's growing up? Oh, I love Darth Vader. Is he learning the Force and being dark and using No, he's just kind of sad.
So I think Joss Whedon, to get out of the doldrums, will have to do a shot-for-shot remake of Chef.
Yeah.
He'll get out of his cage.
Because that worked.
Yeah.
At his house.
At his house.
With all his friends in black and white. Although I really like his version of Midsummer Night's Dream.
Because then Favreau went right back to
Big Jungle Book,
right? Yeah. Which is never coming out. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, wasn't there supposed to be like two Jungle Book movies coming out? And yeah,
well, it's part of a shared universe now, I believe. Jungle Book Origins.
I like it.
Are the two worst words in the English language right now expanded universe, shared universe, some version of
reimagining?
That? Jesus. So the week after, it's 2 weeks between Ultron and Mad Max, right?
Yeah.
What was in between?
Hot Pursuit.
Okay, so just
yeah,
it was. We all fell asleep for a week.
Well, and because then we woke it was up still and, early May.
Yeah,
and we weren't quite in the summer mood.
Hot Pursuit is just now hitting the red box.
My parents are retired, and they watch everything now because they just reserve stuff from the library.
Sure,
and they don't know what it's about, and they just pick it up and then they put it in and they watch it because they're passing time. And my,
but I still applaud that because there are many. People in your parents' demographic who would not give weird stuff a try. So I applaud the fact that they're willing to do that.
My dad watched 25 minutes of Hot Pursuit, and he said that he turned it off after that, that it was just too much. He couldn't listen to Sofia Vergara's voice anymore, and that Reese Witherspoon, even though she has a Southern accent in real life, I believe, she took on like an Appalachian Southern accent, and she was going really broad, and it was just a terrible movie.
Yeah.
I had no interest.
I didn't see it. I can't. Yeah. I feel like it's the kind of movie that will rent well on Redbox because people like Reese Witherspoon for some reason, and other people can look at Sofia Vergara. So then Mad Max Fury Road comes out, and it's great. And we did a podcast on it. And again, it is a summer movie.
That's the
it
one came where out... I got really excited.
Yeah, that was good.
I was afraid I wasn't conveying how great the movie was. And I guess I went overboard because someone in the comments was like, throw a bucket of water on him. I thought I was erring on the side of not pushing the film enough.
I saw, when I saw Jurassic World, it was in a screen where they were just wrapping up Mad Max Fury Road before it. And they were playing the end credits. And it reminded me of how great the score was in Mad Max Fury Road. Oh my God, it's just phenomenal. It's like one of those scores I could just listen to on its own and not, you know, while I'm driving in my 6.4. And,
but I actually get that reference because I get to see the movie.
But it's one. I love the scene in Mad Max Fury Road where Tom Hardy needs to take a shot. And then he just passes the gun over to Charlize Theron because he knows she's better at it than he is. And it's not, oh, you're better at it because you're a woman. It's just that we're peers, and I know that you're better at this than I am because you're sensational at this, and I'm going to use your skill set. And I just think that the whole movie has moments like that.
And a lesser film would have had him say something.
Yeah.
But if anything, one of the many reasons why George Miller is such a terrific filmmaker is he knows when you should talk, and most of the time you don't have to talk because you're what is ambiguous about what we just saw that you should trust your images.
Did you see that George Miller has been rumored to do another Man of Steel movie? Which if he wants to do that, then I think it's great. But if somebody at Warner Brothers is saying, hey, you should do Man of Steel 2 next, I'm not as interested. But if it's something that he wants to come to, then I think, you know, all power to him because he did great by Mad Max. He did great by the Babe sequel from years ago. So when he has, you know, like a passion for the material, I'm always looking forward to what he's got in store.
And I don't know George Miller, and I can't presume to know his intentions. I get the feeling, though, at this stage in his life and his career, I don't see him making a movie like because it's a good next step for his career. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't feel like, oh, Man of Steel 2 might lead to something. Like, I don't think he gives a shit. So if he does it...
Because Man of Steel 2 might lead to the grave.
I have to assume that he wants to. I would be surprised if it happens, but I did hear that rumor as well.
And I finally saw the trailer for this Batman-Superman thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm old.
It has nothing to do with being old.
Yeah, it's coming out the same day as My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, a movie I am more excited about than Batman v Superman.
Half the people that see it are crazy excited, and half the people are kind of like, I don't get it, but, you know, I'll go see it.
It was a joke in I Am Legend. Like, it was a joke. And now we have movies of the joke. It's sad.
What's the joke in I Am Legend?
There is a billboard at the in the opening sequence of I Am Legend of Batman versus Superman. And I thought that was, like, a joke. Because in 2007, you wouldn't... That was pre-Iron Man. You wouldn't anticipate something like that ever coming out.
And is I Am Legend Warner Brothers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it was a joke. Also, I'm starting a groundswell movement. You have a year to prepare for this. Because God knows the Rope and the Colt sing-along worldwide was such an amazing success. We were on Good Morning America. When you go to My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which of course you should, because the first one is so funny, and that's just like my family, you have to bring a bottle of Windex with you.
Yes.
But am I the only one of the three of you who genuinely likes that movie?
You're a terrible person.
Shit.
If you go see it, you have to bring a bottle of Windex, yes. But you also have to promise to drink the Windex. That's the deal.
All right.
It'll be
it
a new,
nice knowing you guys.
It'll be a new weird Jonestown cult.
This is going to be the F this movie version of Drink the Kool-Aid.
Audiences
drink the
everywhere
Windex.
Are dying.
There were parts of My Big Fat Greek Wedding that I liked.
There were no parts.
I think ultimately, though, and then, like, all the bad parts...
The whole movie.
She recycled into...
From the beginning to the end, you're talking
about. I don't even remember what it's called, but Rachel Dratch is in it. They go on a tour of Greece.
Yeah.
My City of Ruins or My Life of Ruins or something
yeah.
like that?
Okay. And...
Yeah.
Yeah.
My Life's in Ruins?
Something like that.
You can see
it's
it.
A pun. It's funny.
They did I Hate Valentine's Day also, and that
she's
was...
She's a talent.
One of the worst movies I've ever
Tom
seen.
Tom Hanks decided to back her.
That My Life in Ruins... Oh, I just... Oh, now I... Because...
Yes.
Her, okay,
it.
It's a pun.
And it's funny...
Is a deconstruction of everything in My Big Fat Greek Wedding that doesn't work. Is Andrea Martin going to return for number two?
What the hell else is Andrea Martin
You know
doing?
Everybody from that movie is going to return.
No, Andrea Martin does a lot of Broadway. No joke.
And Andrea Martin's great. I'm not knocking Andrea Martin, but like, of
she's
going to
be like,
she's going to be back.
She's going to be like, understudy.
Also,
I've got a movie to shoot.
Trivia.
Have you
tidbit.
Ever been in a movie?
Trivia tidbit, because I never knew this. This was either in her book or Steve Martin's book, or Steve Martin wrote an introduction to her book. I never knew this. Back in the Second City days, she was famous for flashing people.
I did not know that.
What is that? Like during an improv scene or something,
sure.
or backstage or something. Who
and
knew?
They would say, yes, and?
Yeah,
and?
They used to call her ATM, Andrea Titty Martin.
I don't even feel like, so Mad Max Fury Road, I think we're all in agreement, is the best movie of the summer. Yes?
Of the blockbuster. Of the blockbusters.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I had some indie stuff that was more my personal favorite.
Sure.
Mad Max. But of the blockbusters, yes.
I would say hands down. And then the fiery furnace of love that Mad Max engenders gets a big bucket of cold water thrown on it the next week.
Is Jurassic World the next
when
week?
When Tomorrowland
opens. Oh, Tomorrowland.
Opens.
You know what? I never saw Tomorrowland.
Oh, my God.
You are a better person for it.
I'll catch up with it on Blu-ray.
Talk about an interesting concept and a lot of money.
Yeah.
Wasted. Because Tomorrowland could have worked. I think it was my wife who had this idea. Spoiler alert, not that you should see it, that we start at the World's Fair. When Disney had two things running, It's a Small World and the Carousel of Progress. And my wife suggested that Walt Disney should have been a character in the film in terms of what he stood for and how he felt about the future. But George Clooney is just...
Really miscast.
If you would like an example of miscasting, yeah. It just doesn't work.
I appreciate... The visuals in Tomorrowland,
yeah,
it's very disappointing that it's a Brad Bird movie, and it seems like it's definitely his movie, him and Lindelof, but it just doesn't work at all. And the thing that I found the thing that's most memorable to me about Tomorrowland is just everything around it, because at the time, I was in LA on vacation, and they were really promoting Tomorrowland out the ass, and like in... Disneyland, like, they shut down Captain EO just to show, like, a behind-the-scenes look at Tomorrowland, and then they were selling, like, the Funko figures of Tomorrowland and stuff. And
that, to me, is the height of hubris.
Yeah, they were really hoping that this thing would hit, and it is a movie for no one.
And I actually thought, it's interesting you brought up the theme park, because I'm a big fan of the theme parks, that when we saw Tomorrowland, it seemed like there could have been a 20-minute version in 3D with maybe something where water spritzes at you that was an attraction in Tomorrowland.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of those movies where it sort of sets the scene for what this land of the park is, but much more a theme park attraction than a movie. And that movie is just so confused about what it wants to be.
Yeah.
And the message that it wants to put out.
I hope that it goes into storage for a while and the idea gets revived in 15 or 20 years, because I think another director could really make something out of it, but it just doesn't work in its current iteration.
And I've said this before, a former student who wound up going to Columbia for film school came up with an idea for a movie based on Space Mountain, mm-hmm. the attraction,
mm-hmm.
that is, I've talked about this before on the podcast, that is so infinitely better than Tomorrowland. There's a problem if the layman can trump the professionals.
Maybe he'll sell it. I just heard they greenlit a Jungle Cruise movie starring The Rock.
Which is odd, because anyone who knows Disneyland and Disney World, the Jungle Cruise is this threadbare attraction that only exists because Disney is loath to replace anything, because they know parents want their kids to see the mm-hmm. thing that they really thought. Have either of you been on the Jungle Cruise lately?
Not lately. Yeah. I skipped it when I was
like a year ago. Disneyland.
Okay.
Yeah. Fake animals and bad jokes.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny that the Jurassic Park ride at Universal kind of replicated the Jungle Cruise for the most part.
Well, you know what? And I was thinking about that because lately, visiting my son, I've been to all these theme parks a lot, especially Universal. And I'm not the first person to point this out. On every ride in Universal, you're going to steal the AllSpark. You're going to help this cause. You're going to take a pleasant tour of the facility. And every ride has the same narrative. Halfway through, something horrible goes wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Are they aware that every ride is telling the same story? Say what you want about Disney. The rides are designed as adventures, and the adventures are different.
My favorite example of that is on a Test Track at Disney World. Your key fob will stop working because the key battery is too low, so you can't even ride the ride.
For just a second, I thought you were serious, and I was wondering what horrible thing goes wrong. Yeah. Oh, so no.
You have to take your car to the service department.
Test Track. Halfway through the ride, there's traffic. You get stuck.
Something's wrong.
And you have to sit in your car for an hour, just like in real life.
So let me ask you this, in terms of our attention deficit disorder when it comes to summer movies. The week that Tomorrowland comes out, everyone is saying, yeah, Disney's kind of taking a bath on it. Brad Bird, Misfire, George Clooney, this movie didn't work for that week, right?
And they announced the sequel?
No, but for some reason, everyone's
still... It's called The Day After Tomorrowland.
Whoa. Still points to, like, John Carter is still the reference point. And John Carter, I'm not making this, like, a personal cause of mine, but that's still the reference point for recent... big bomb, right?
Well,
movie that shouldn't have been, movie that they shouldn't have hired this Pixar director to make live action. They went over budget. Why? What were they thinking? And again, we have the movie that came out this summer that fits into theoretically all of those same categories, and yet it gets a pass. And I just wonder if that has anything to do, again, I haven't seen Tomorrowland, so I'm not comparing the quality of the two films, but does that again have to do with the fact that we forget everything a week later now? We're still stuck on John Carter from 2010. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about Tomorrowland from this summer because, hey, this other thing came out a week later, which is actually true, right? Because isn't Jurassic World the next week?
No, that was like 2 or 3 weeks later. I think the thing is with Tomorrowland, and I haven't seen John Carter. That's bad on me because I obviously you guys are big fans of it.
I really like John
good.
Carter.
Tomorrowland is just... it's bad in a way that's really forgettable. There's no, there's not many things where it's just like egregiously awful. It's just that
John Carter,
it's so dull.
It's been exactly 3 months. It came out 3 months ago today.
Wow. So
and
it's an anniversary.
The 3 month retrospective of Yay! Tomorrowland.
Do you want to get out my review and just read it in different voices?
Let's do like a BuzzFeed piece. Okay.
And
about,
speaking
yeah.
speaking,
things you didn't know about Tomorrowland.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to your point,
number one, Tomorrowland came out. You didn't know that.
I remember the female lead is upset about NASA taking the launch platform down.
We all are.
And I remember the World's Fair sequence because I thought that was well done and interesting to use CGI to recreate the past. And I remember George Clooney being miscast because that part really demands an irascible asshole who we only later learn is that way because
Robert
he's
Duvall.
Been horribly hurt. Oh, and I also remember...
Get the hell out of Tomorrowland! What part of that don't you understand, soldier?
And that George Clooney, because of a vagary of the plot involving robots, really seems to be in love with a 12-year-old, which we can't get beyond that because I understand what they were trying. He fell in love with her when he was 12. He's aged. She hasn't.
Yeah.
But even if that's the case, you got to wrap your arm around George and say.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to what you were saying about forgetting, I thought this was like reasonably groundbreaking because I was thinking about this over the summer when I wrote the review of Man in the Dark, which is that 3D film noir that has every 3D trick in it. Because say what you want about Man in the Dark, it delivers on throwing shit in your face. That... Could there be a meta theory going on among big studios to make these films fade because we have to make room for next week's? Because a lot of this has to do with the number of theaters there are. But I remember when I was growing up, get off my lawn, that Jaws played all summer.
Mm-hmm.
It never left. And we can't have that anymore because we have next week's film. So they're designed to sort of be entertaining. I thought Ant-Man was entertaining as I watched it, and then it sort of dissolved into dust. And there was another film this summer that I thought the same thing about, that it was perfectly fine, and then not. I think maybe it was Avengers Age of Ultron, that they're deliberately making disposable entertainment because the business model is based on one or two weekends and then get out of the way.
I mean, I don't think that that's the case. I think a studio would be much happier if their movie played all summer long. And I don't know, again, if it has to do with this idea that movies are now made for global audiences who don't necessarily speak the language or can't. Aren't interested in some complexities or whatever, and so
or dialogue
that Jurassic World plays to everyone.
Jurassic World was my other example.
Oh, it was not perfectly fine when you were watching it. You were thinking of a different movie.
Well, it was the same thing I thought about the Wolfman remake because it's the same thing as Godzilla. I like the Wolfman, and I'm in Universal Horror Town for 2 hours. And because I have such tremendous affection for the original, because it's a masterpiece.
Talking about Jurassic Park.
Yes.
Got it.
Jurassic World managed to waft enough fumes of that. It's a theme park with dinosaurs. Am I saying it's a good movie? No. It's a really, really bad, misguided movie in a number of ways. But while it was playing, I was entertained.
I had a blast at Jurassic World, and I know that it's not a good movie. There's a lot of things, just even on the surface while you're watching it, that you know it's not the best quality, but I don't know what it was, something in the air, but like it just, I've seen it a few times, and I just had fun each and every time. I'm glad you brought up the Universal Monsters, because it's like the House of Frankenstein or Son of Frankenstein version to or Jurassic Park's Frankenstein or Bride of Frankenstein. So that's how I equate it. It was so much more entertaining than The Lost World. It was so much more entertaining than Jurassic Park 3. I in terms of just pure fun, I would put it pretty high up there this summer.
I have no response. I did not. There's nothing about it that I liked.
So this is interesting because you two are on completely opposite poles.
We did a show about it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
we did.
And
I was wrong, apparently.
No, I'm in the middle.
No, I know.
The comments bore that out.
The comments were, you're wrong.
Yeah, I felt, yeah, that.
Oh, yeah, no, okay.
That made me feel
now
bad.
I remember.
Yeah.
My God, it was like 75. It was crazy.
It's all right.
75 comments. But,
and that's the biggest movie of the summer. I mean, that's the movie that defines this summer, which I don't think anybody saw coming. It's the third highest grossing movie of all time, ever, of all the movies that have come out. Does that depress anyone else at this table?
It's depressing.
Of all movies that come out, the fourth best Jurassic Park movie is one of the highest grossing movies of all time.
It's depressing, but it's no more depressing than the Avengers used to be the number third grossing movie of all time, or that Avatar is the highest grossing movie of all time. I mean, it's no more depressing to me than that, but
I guess at least
it doesn't
those
mean anything.
Two movies, no, you're, it absolutely does not. And the only thing that lets me sleep at night is that at least with the other two movies that you mentioned, they were doing something that hadn't quite done before.
No, I completely agree.
Been done before.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah. You're right, it doesn't matter.
Here's a perfect metaphor for Jurassic World. I might have talked about this before on the podcast, but not as a metaphor. I saw Jurassic World in L.A. because I was in L.A. and I actually saw it at the home of Universal City Walk. And they had the costumes on display in the lobby, which was fun. And outside, they had that ball.
The gyrosphere.
Thing, the gyrosphere.
Yeah.
And it was set up so you could look at it and take a picture of it and advertise their movie. And they had two or three security guards guarding the gyrosphere so no one fucked with it. And certainly you couldn't go sit in it. And I thought, well, there's a missed opportunity. Because if you just have the security guards making sure that people don't fuck with it, you sitting in the goddamn thing is a much better picture than it empty. And certainly you're going to be more likely to tweet or Facebook or Instagram a picture of you sitting in the goddamn thing, which would advertise your movie, especially if you were smart enough to put something by the ball that said coming soon. And so my metaphor for Jurassic World is an empty ball.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like on the surface, it seems so competent and I understand why people had fun with it, but then I also don't because I just think it's so hollow that I'm like, so are we really just okay with like, hey, they did dinosaurs on screen? Because I don't think any of the things that we actually go to movies for are in that movie. I think it seems like they are, and this we don't need to do a Jurassic
and
Park
again,
show.
Like Prometheus,
we did it,
which should be something in the glossary. The minute you start thinking about it, it falls apart. The minute you start thinking about those gyrospheres as a real thing in an amusement park, it just, no.
Yeah,
which is not my problem with the movie.
I'm a little sad, though, that it seems like the Colin Trevorrow, who did Safety Not Guaranteed, has already been replaced by the one who's going to be making the Jurassic Worlds and the Star Wars.
Hard to say. He's only made two movies.
Right,
you know what I mean? Like we've handed him the keys to Star Wars.
Yeah. I have hope
because Jurassic World made a lot of money. It's like I don't know which filmmaker he is because I didn't like Jurassic World. I like Safety Not Guaranteed.
Yeah.
So which guy is he? I need a tiebreaker movie.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
And apparently that's going to be fucking Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, maybe like Avengers. We used to say that really good directors would do one for themselves and one for the studio.
Yeah.
Maybe in the hustle bustle of the 21st century and the new commerce in Hollywood, you make one scene in a movie for you and then one scene in a movie for them. And so it schizophrenically goes back and forth. And then San Andreas comes out.
Yes.
Which I also saw in L.A., which was terrifying.
Yeah.
It's like you with the Portage. You expect a wrecking ball to come through the wall at any moment. I love disaster movies. It went straight by the playbook. In one of my columns, I laid out, here's what a disaster movie has to do. And I actually sat in the theater and, like, counted them off. There's someone who predicts it. No one listens to him. There's one guy who knows everything. It's not good.
No.
But it was so much fun.
I had a great time watching it, too. But I can't tell how much of that was because I saw it at the former Grauman's Chinese Theater, and I was just kind of caught up in the experience of it. So,
and you were in the big theater.
Yeah, the big theater. Which really, it was phenomenal. I mean, the screen, it's an IMAX screen, and they said it's like the third largest screen in the country. And to
did
watch,
you two young men know that that was sort of every theater at one time? That
Yeah, I'm from the wrong era. I mean, I would have really... Thank you. I would have really loved to have been around during that time. But
didn't McClure Court used to have the biggest screen just in the city, or was it in the country?
Well,
I remember seeing Heavy Metal there.
McClure Court was amazing. But there was another theater, and I'm trying to remember its name because I went to it the week before it closed.
The Admiral.
No, that's very different. The week before it closed. And was split into 13 screens.
Ooh.
Or, well, I don't think they do 13, maybe 14, and you had to get in an elevator for some of them. So imagine the space that we can carve up. And not the Oriental. When it was still one theater, the last week they were showing Lost in America with Albert Brooks. And earlier on Thanksgiving night, my wife and I became sick of the in-laws, and we went there to see... White Knights.
Movies that need to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, neither.
The movie that designed this summer, White Knights.
It was breathtaking, and I think that theater
still haven't seen
it. I haven't
held several thousand.
Yeah. Wow.
It was just awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
And we've
back to
something.
San Andreas.
Yes.
That is, I did not see it, and I don't want that to be a recurring theme on this podcast, but it might be. San Andreas, unlike Tomorrowland, which I wanted to see and just was not able to, San Andreas, I will say, actively avoid, because I would see the trailers and think, that's not why I go to movies. I'm just maybe not a fan of disaster movies.
I think the sheer star power of Dwayne Johnson puts that movie
over. The fact that I did not go out on opening night to see a movie that stars both Alexander Daddario and Carla Gugino occupying the same space means that something was really repelling me from going to see that movie.
Was Carla Gugino the wife?
Yes.
It was just so much fun. I'm sorry. I'm not proud of myself, but it was fun.
I have a hard time having fun just watching mass destruction and death. And I'm not saying like, hey, something's wrong with you because you have fun with it. The trailer gave me anxiety. Like, I don't like those kinds of movies.
For some reason, because I agree with you, like, I think it was when we did the Sandlot show, we were talking about how tired we are of the mass destruction with Man of Steel and World War Z, and it was all those, like, back-to-back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But with San Andreas, it kind of took on, I don't know how, it's maybe just a tone thing, but like Independence Day, I'm not thinking about the mass destruction.
Sure.
I'm thinking about just this spectacle.
And to San Andreas's credit, at least that's what the movie is about.
Yeah.
Like when we were bemoaning that stuff from other blockbusters from last year, the year before, it was this weird side effect of this other thing that was going on. It was just like, we're telling you this story, and oh yeah, by the way, we've leveled cities as a consequence.
If you watch the Superman versus Batman trailer, there's two shots. It's like, enough with 9/11.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be the same 9/11 from Man of Steel,
right,
though.
Right.
It's just seen
it's
from
Batman
a different angle.
Reacting to what happened in Man of Steel.
Yeah.
One, please. What else?
Can we talk about, I've got a quartet of terrible.
Oh.
Aloha.
If Doug were here.
Yes.
That could be this podcast.
It's like the opposite of the Magnificent Seven.
Exactly. The Quartet of Terrible. Aloha is bad in ways that are catastrophic.
Aloha
is... What did the one guy call us?
The Menage a Trois of Stupid.
Okay, thank you.
Aloha
is the sequel.
Okay, so I'll name the four first. Aloha.
Yeah.
Poltergeist.
Oof.
Terminator Genesis.
God damn it.
And Fantastic Four.
I saw every one of those movies. Yeah. I missed some actual good movies this summer, I think, and saw every one of those goddamn pieces of shit.
Those movies are incompetent. Like, they're not just bad. They're, like, made...
Yeah.
Movies made by people where it's like you write a paper for school and you don't proofread it and you turn it in with a bunch of grammatical errors and it's just awful.
Yes.
That's what those movies are.
Yes. 100%. Yes. If I were to... I think Poltergeist might be the best of those four, and I did not like Poltergeist.
I would go Terminator Genesis as the best of those four, and that movie is so bad that I walked out into the lobby just to remind myself of what I had to look forward to once the end credits started rolling. Like, I left the movie. I left the movie.
There is
I've done, I've done that before.
And there left is the a movie life. And looked at posters for like 15
life.
Minutes.
There is a life after this movie.
I've done that before.
Of those four, I only saw Terminator. And as opposed to what I was saying before, it was pleasant while you were in it, and then it fell apart. At no point was Terminator entertaining. And again, it's early in the morning. Like, slap me on the face if I said this at the very beginning of the podcast. Because I was talking to you about this Thursday night.
Oh, dick. It's dark in here. Why can't you turn out the lights when we do these?
I'll just light a couple more candles.
Okay.
That because of Adam reviewing a lot of new releases.
I'm sorry.
You have given me hundreds of dollars and hours of time because I was going to go see Vacation.
And they're all redeemable for Blu-rays of Parkland.
No, this same thing happened to me where it was very hard for me to go see a movie this summer. So I really had to like make the choice and make the effort. And a lot of times it was like, because I know I'm going to review it. And so what would happen is if I didn't get out to see a movie in the first 2 to 3 days of its release, Monday, your review ran. And I'm like, well, Adam already reviewed it. And he says it's bad. Why am I going to make the effort to go see it? You know, like however, after 2 weeks, do I still need to try to go see Ted 2? Maybe not.
But you know what, though? You and I, we used to agree a lot more, and now we kind of disagree more. So you might like some of the ones that I say are bad. I wouldn't use that as a
barometer. Would Patrick like Vacation?
No. Well, I would. All right. I'll just say it. No sensible human being would like Vacation.
What if you were one of those shit freaks? What if you were one of those who was really into shit? Yeah.
He's imagine, asking for a friend.
Yeah.
imagine the guy buying a ticket. Is this the movie where Christina Applegate puts...
Let me put it this way. Yeah, that's the type of movie that like I imagine Jared Fogle would really like.
Too soon, guys.
We have a new rating for Vacation for coprophiliacs only.
Yeah.
And when they put shit all over each other,
I get to see the script.
The movie reviews itself.
I get to see the script writing meeting. It's just like, and she rubs the shit on her face, and then he rubs the he gurgles the shit water and spits it out.
She rubs the shit on her face because I couldn't get a date in high school.
And that's written by the same guy who played Sam on Freaks and Geeks, and that breaks my heart.
Yeah.
But you mentioned this in your review. For some twisted reason, and at this point I blame my students, when did utter mean-spiritedness become comedy? Because they also did the Horrible Bosses movies.
Yeah.
And even the first one, I went to see it and I thought, this is just kind of shitty. This is like a parade of shitty behavior.
The first one looks like a great movie compared to Vacation and Horrible Bosses 2.
Well, I did not go see Horrible Bosses 2, but again, thank you, because I almost last night made a list of all the movies I avoided this year by reading your reviews, and as people have commented, thank you for taking one for the team.
Entourage.
Oof.
That's another bad one.
Forgot about Entourage.
That Entourage is it would make a good double feature with Vacation because it's just these terrible, poisonous, antiquated mindsets that or worldviews that the filmmakers have. Where everything in Entourage, I mean, the show was misogynistic, but the movie is that times 20.
Why is that happening?
I don't get it.
What's going on?
I don't know.
Culturally, that has become the norm. I mean, we talked about Terminator Genesis. I don't know how much time we need to spend on Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
You know, that movie obviously is just was not done or was done by somebody else. And
the
soap
opera behind it is unlike anything that you usually see.
And playing out so publicly, which I find fascinating as well.
I mean, somebody's going to write a really good book about that movie.
I hope so.
I don't want to see a documentary, but I want to see a book about it.
Unfortunately, we're just going to get some fucking documentary. Here's the movie they almost made. Fuck you guys. I don't know that will happen. Once upon a time, that had to happen, because that's the only way we would hear the story.
Yeah.
But now there's so many goddamn articles about it on the internet, I don't know if anybody's going to sit down and be like, let me tell the actual story, because we all have access to it all the time. You know, I wish there was one definitive account.
My favorite story about the Fantastic Four brouhaha is that Josh Trank sent out an email to the cast members the day before it came out saying, like, you should be proud of this movie. It's better than 90% of the other superhero movies that are out. And one of them replied back, no, it's not.
Wow.
Who do we think it was? Who do we think replied back?
I think it was probably Kate Mara.
You think so?
Yeah.
They did not get along. Her or her wig. So what else was good? I mean,
I liked The Gift. I thought The Gift was a pleasant surprise based on how kind of generic the trailer was. I was expecting Unlawful Entry, and it turned into something a little bit more complex. And
pleasant surprise is a good way to describe it.
I enjoyed that one a lot.
The Gift was one of those interesting cases where they had this trailer that I think was bad. It was badly put together.
Yes.
And I think explained too much. And then I don't think the trailer tracked. I think they did some polling of some sort. Because then, and you guys have seen this before, the second trailer comes out, which I thought was really hilarious, because the first trailer explained too much. And then the second trailer explained even more, even having the trope of going back and forth between scenes from the movie and the actors talking about what the movie was about.
I never saw that trailer.
And then that explained even more. But one of the reasons why I gave The Gift credit is that they actually sold it as what you're talking about, but it turned out to be not exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That for once in a summer, the twist was not telegraphed.
I read a review that I liked. I think it was Michael Phillips in the Chicago Tribune, and he said that it was a movie that was smaller than the advertising would lead you to believe. And I thought that was interesting. And it's cool to see that in a movie. You don't get that very often.
It's good. And I think it's a movie that will be talked about for a long time. Not by a ton of people, but I think everybody who kind of stumbles upon it or who saw it and is trying to turn other people on to something that, like, oh, you should give this a chance. I think that's going to be one of those movies.
And Jason Bateman he's never bad. Ever in a movie.
No, he shows up because that other movie, The Family,
This Is Where I Leave You,
shows up on HBO a lot, and I find it weirdly watchable for a couple minutes at a time, and he's really good in that. And the movie's not great, but he's really good in it. He's always really good.
And he was like that in Disconnected, was another dramatic performance. He's the only good thing in that movie.
Okay, because you had brought up Disconnect in your review of The Gift, and I was like, what? Because I actually went to see Disconnect in a theater, and oh my God.
Disconnect is still better than the other same movie that came out. Jason Reitman.
Scared of the Internet.
Men, Women, and Children?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, that was that bad.
Oh yeah.
Movies to scare grandma about the Internet.
That was like bad, like Cameron Crowe made it bad.
Are you on that Internet? No. Because I saw a movie the other night that said it was bullying and pornography. There's the Internet movie.
Bullying and pornography. That's my life.
So, Ryan, would you say in terms of a busy...
This is the second time. Do you know that?
What?
Yeah.
It's the second time today he called you Ryan.
Because I'm getting old and your last name is Risky.
You know what the great part about that is? I must not have been listening to anything you're saying because I missed it both times.
Once was before we recorded.
This was in the kitchen.
He said Ryan wanted waffles. I was like, who the fuck is Ryan?
I think I know why.
Why?
Because I'm a shadow recruit.
So, Adam.
Yeah.
In a crowded summer movie season, would you say The Gift was a gift to the moviegoer?
Yeah, I would not return it to sender.
Would you? That question clearly should have been addressed to Lights, Camera, Adam, and not actual Adam.
Lights, Camera, Jack. I haven't seen this yet, but the movie to close out the summer is, I guess, American Ultra or Sinister or Hitman or whatever. But
savage reviews for all three.
Lights, Camera, Jackson savage. Gave American Ultra an F, and that makes me want to see it so much more.
The enemy of my enemy is
my friend.
Yes.
Yeah. What little I know about this little succubus, I know exactly what rubbed him the wrong way about American Ultra. Yeah. Also, I brought this up on a previous podcast, but It's becoming true in spades that little by little, either an individual theater or the Chicago Film Critics Society or TCM or Cinemark is actually that you could sort of cobble together repertory screenings on your own without going to the music box. So I can't let this podcast finish up without mentioning that this summer I also saw Jaws in a theater and Them and The Deadly Mantis and Back to the Future and Double Indemnity and The Breakfast Club and A Hard Day's Night and Help. And all of those things are good and should continue. In fact, TCM's September movie is Psycho, which makes no sense because then the Chicago Film Critics in October are screening Psycho.
Yeah.
Back to movies that actually came out this
year. Man from U.N.C.L.E. is another movie that's perfectly pleasant. And then...
Yeah, I think... Would you agree that if they maybe casted it... I don't know what the plural form of that is. Better... with more charismatic actors, it might have been an even better movie.
Who's more charismatic than Henry Cavill?
The woman...
A calf.
The woman was cute, but was given nothing to do.
She's Ex Machina, right?
I actually liked Armie Hammer, but Henry Cavill, who it took me till halfway through the movie, I turned to Jan and said, oh, that's Superman. Mm-hmm. Henry Cavill...
I didn't recognize him without him destroying a city and murdering innocent people.
That Clark Kent thing really works for you.
Henry Cavill seems to be doing an impression of someone doing an impression of James Bond.
Yeah.
That the performance was so studied. But here's what I think is the big part. Because plot-wise, I thought the plot worked. It was sort of James Bond-ish. But I thought the film had two big, big problems. Can you name one memorable line of dialogue from that movie?
Hello, yeah. I'm the man from U.N.C.L.E.
I don't know if it's...
I didn't see it.
I'm not going to get it verbatim, but it was...
Let's sue him in federal court.
Armie Hammer says to Alicia Vikander, she's drinking like glass after glass of vodka, and he just says, can I just get you a bigger glass? And I thought that was funny.
That's true. Yeah. I also thought there were too many villains, and except for one, they were very unmemorable.
They're very interchangeable.
They should have...
I missed
the torturing guy?
Yeah.
Was interesting, but then they...
I miss the guy Ritchie of Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, who kind of had his own thing and own voice, and now it seems like Sherlock Holmes and Man from U.N.C.L.E. are... They have like a visual, stylistic identity, but like it's kind of like a Mick G thing.
Yeah, very much.
I don't know. I just feel like that filmmaker is evolved into something less interesting.
That there are several chase scenes in Man from U.N.C.L.E. and they're all very loud and edited together in a very jarring way that ignores spatial relationships and time. And I much prefer longer shots in terms of duration and a real sense of where everyone is at the same time instead of just biff, bam, boom. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's this style that he's... engendering. I was a fan of the TV show.
Yeah.
And
the biggest crime is it comes 2 weeks after Rogue Nation. And in comparison, it looks like...
And Patrick had said that in his review.
Worthless.
That with... what was the previous one? Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
That with Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation, Mission Impossible sort of raised the bar.
Yeah.
That you really can't get away with shitty action anymore because, look, this is the way you do it.
One thing I want to ask you guys, because I think we all liked Rogue Nation.
Yes.
We
have eyes, brains, souls.
All right, so there's like 4 or 5 action set pieces, and I thought they all worked. They were all really entertaining, really well put together. I didn't think the story was all that interesting around it. It didn't really matter because of the actors being charismatic and the action sequences, but I just really didn't think the story was all that strong.
Do you think that the story is really strong in any of the Mission Impossible movies?
I think I'm a big fan of 3 because I think there's like an emotional element to it, like an undercurrent because it's his wife in this one.
Right, sure.
So I think there's a little bit more vested interest, whereas this one it just felt like kind of, it's hard to describe, but I don't know. Maybe maybe not.
Three, I think, even kind of makes a joke about the lack of story by just flat out calling it the rabbit's foot and never telling us what it is.
Yeah.
That they're acknowledging the fact that, look, what it is doesn't matter.
Mm.
The story is, how are we going to get out of this thing?
Yeah.
Because that's what every set piece is. Like, we're going to do this, and then 10 things go wrong, and how do we get out of it?
Mm.
And I think Rogue Nation, I think was the most entertained I was in a movie this year, this summer especially. I wouldn't call it my favorite movie of the summer, because obviously I think Mad Max Fury Road is insanely entertaining and a great movie, whereas I think Rogue Nation is just entertaining, you know, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I think it's better at doing what it wants to do than 99% of movies that came out this summer.
And I thought it was wonderfully entertaining, and not as the biggest, I'm not the biggest fan of the Mission Impossible series, but I would argue that you're right. Because when I look back to Ghost Protocol, I can remember the action scenes, which I thought were amazing. But I would be hard-pressed to tell you what they were in the service of. Because Rogue Nation is relatively recent in my memory. Oh, they want to shut this down, and they want to keep it going because there's an evil version of it, and they have to break into the impregnable fortress. Once you've seen a lot of action films, in fact, Ebert laid it out once. I think there's five. The impregnable fortress impregnated, and then there's four more, and then that's what it is.
Rebecca Ferguson wears the hell out of that dress in that one scene. Oh my God.
That movie should make her a movie star.
You reviewed it for the site, right?
Correct.
I thought it was really interesting when you brought up that the director gives her this amazing fight scene, which, and we learned this in so many other action films, that they're, in fact, this is in David Mamet's book, Bambi Meets Godzilla, that the character's trying to do something and they're kept from doing it in something. And certainly in the scene where Tom Cruise has to go underwater, there's all kinds of things that are stopping him from doing that. That's such a wonderful, what's the word? In fact, there's a whole movie with this as its title. Let's call it an obstruction, that having her do that scene in that dress is just inspired.
Yeah. No, I really, really liked, you know, that and Fury Road and Trainwreck. And
yep.
I think there was like one other, Inside Out. I mean,
here's my list.
There might be one more of like the big movies that I liked. That might be it.
From January to the very end of April, I was in a coma. Let's just pretend that I was in a coma.
I like this game.
And then tomorrow, I go back into the coma.
I like this game even more.
Until New Year's, when I'm magically revived, because who doesn't like to celebrate New Year's?
Who revives you so we can stop them?
By the way, last year, New Year's Eve, I watched Men, Women, and Children. So I don't like to celebrate New Year's, just to bring it back to that goddamn movie.
I went to a local hotel with friends and drank and listened to bands.
I got into a car accident at 1 a.m. So,
you win!
So I win.
Ding, ding, ding.
You're the winner.
Yeah. If I had to come up with a list just based on this summer, here was the list. The End of the Tour, which we didn't talk about.
No, and again, I was kind of waiting to get into more of that kind of counter-programming, because I'm still more than talking about the big wide release stuff that I liked. I came up with four.
Did you guys see...
Four counter-programming or four...
Four big movies.
Oh, okay.
Did you guys see Southpaw or Straight Outta Compton?
Oh, Straight Outta Compton I liked with reservations. I did not see Southpaw.
See, it's funny because when I watched it and wrote about Straight Outta Compton, I think I liked it more than I do now, because I did not know about how much they kind of skipped over in some, in especially
Dr.
Dre's life.
Whitewashes the truth?
Again.
Which, all right, in biopics, like, they do that all the time.
Yeah,
the only time it's like warts and all is like Raging Bull, which, so
Raging Bull, they actually added warts.
So I have to overlook that. So I have to overlook the fact that biopics do this, because otherwise I'll never enjoy any of them. But no, I thought Straight Outta Compton was a celebration of that era of music.
Correct.
And Thank you. Thank you. So as a fan of that style of music, I think that it did a tremendous job, and I liked its length. I like that I look forward to movies when I hear that they're 2.5 hours or 3 hours or something like that. Cause then I'm just like, oh, they're going to take their time and really go through this. And I thought that's what Straight Outta Compton did.
Yes and no. I mean, I admire the fact that they tried to make it this epic, but I feel like the movie ran out of stuff to say in terms of having like a cohesive story. Here's the story of what happened. Mm-hmm. Once Ice Cube leaves, it just becomes like, and then this, and then he went on to do this. And can you believe that, like, the night Tupac was here was also the night that we wrote California Love? It just, like, it had to give you the greatest hits of everything. Here's Ice Cube writing Friday. Like, that gives me such douche chills. Yeah, I can't even tell you. So they just wanted to throw in, like, and did you know this? And remember this? It was, like, the weird greatest hits. And you had said in your review that it falls victim to, like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And none of that stuff worked for me as well as, like, that first hour when the movie really seemed to be about something more than just biographical details carefully selected, you know? Like, only specific biographical details are included. I still enjoyed the movie. I was entertained by it. I think its first hour or so, maybe hour and a half, is really strong.
Yeah.
And then I think
it makes me want to see a movie about Suge Knight. Like, I would love to see a biopic
about Suge Knight. It's called Angel Heart.
As someone, that's very good. As someone who's not
the biggest, called Insidious 4.
As someone who's not the biggest fan of the band, because that's not the music I grew up with, I thought the movie was very prescient in being released right now, in that the first hour really makes a case for the LA police being a destructive force in certain communities. And I think it gets that point across really, really well and shows you where their most controversial song comes from, etc. In fact, one of the things I really liked, because I'm an old fat white guy, is how incensed the Paul Giamatti character becomes the first time he's subjected to just a little taste of what they're subjected to every day. And I know my wife said one of her favorite parts is when Ice Cube records that answer song.
No Vaseline?
What really gets Giamatti upset is the anti-Semitism.
Right.
Although Ice Cube later says he's not anti-Semitic, he's anti the Paul Giamatti character.
Right, right. Super entertaining, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a good time with it.
Did you guys see Southpaw?
No.
No, and again, I didn't because of your review.
And I gave it a somewhat positive review.
I any movie for me with Jake Gyllenhaal is worth watching, and that's why I went. And the acting is good, and I'm a sucker for boxing movies, so overall, it's not a good movie. It's very cliche, but I thought it was... It's a good, like, cable watch.
I will absolutely see it. That's a perfect example of, like, I didn't see it the opening weekend. I read your review. I'm like, I'm probably not going to make, like, too much of an effort to rush out and see Southpaw at this point.
Yeah.
I also felt the trailer gave away way too
much. Oh, boy,
did it. Yeah, that's the worst trailer of the year.
Boy, did it.
Because in the spirit of Unstoppable, we're watching the trailer. Gee, you think he gets back together with his kids? That'd be a very different movie if he didn't, right?
Go ahead.
Oh, another movie with a bad trailer that is actually better than the trailer is Ricky and the Flash. It's not a great movie, but the trailer made it look like Mamma Mia 2.
Yeah.
And
it looks like some Nancy Meyers shit.
Yeah, if you're a Jonathan Demme fan, there's a lot of like little fan service moments where it's like, oh, that guy was in Rachel Getting Married. That's the keyboardist from the Talking Heads. So, like, there's all this stuff in it that's kind of neat, but it's a movie that could have been made by anybody, which, like, I felt like the most disappointing Jonathan Demme movies are like that, or
The Truth About Charlie.
Truth About Charlie, Manchurian Candidate remake, things like that.
My wife went to see it with your wife, Patrick, and was very surprised that Rick Springfield was in it because she didn't recognize him in the trailer.
He might be the best part of the movie. He's got like a kind of natural screen presence.
He was also the best part of True Detective Season 2.
I did not see it.
I'm just kidding.
He was not the best
part. Is Kevin Kline in it a lot?
Yeah, he's like the second lead of it.
Yeah.
And he's good in it. I thought Meryl Streep can't sing, and that was bugging me, especially on some of... There's a few songs where it seems like...
Did you see Into the Woods?
Yeah. Well, there's a few songs...
After Into the Woods and Mamma Mia, that's like Hollywood heresy.
Well, there's a few songs where you can tell that she tried a little bit more. It's like she rehearsed it twice instead of once, but...
Isn't she supposed to not be super good, though?
She's supposed to be like a bar band singer.
Right.
But I mean, like, even by a bar band singer standards, like, she's not... And I hear a lot of, like, bar bands, like, where I live. There's just... You can hear them out...
In bars. He lives in bars.
I live in bars, yeah.
He's an alcoholic.
I do.
She also sings. How do you think I had the Postcards from the Edge?
How do you think I had the accident at 1 a.m. on New Year's Eve?
She also sings in Prairie Home Companion. She's done a lot of singing.
She sure has.
She snaps too much.
She's not that good.
She sings at the end of... Conjoined Twins, Stuck on You.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you guys remember that movie?
I walked out of it.
Really?
Yeah. I've seen the movie.
It's not the worst. They put on a big musical at the end, because like it's Greg Kinnear's dream to be in a musical or something, and Meryl Streep does a cameo where she sings.
I don't remember that at all.
It happens, everyone.
Did you dream that?
Nope.
Did you Someone back
me up.
That?
Someone back me up.
Or is that a dream?
Am I missing any of the big movies that are good or exceptionally bad?
Well, you mentioned Trainwreck already, but we didn't really talk about it.
My favorite comedy of the summer?
Yeah, I think it's probably the funniest movie of the summer.
Yeah?
I laughed more. It's a film that's not without its faults.
No.
It's funnier than Spy.
Although...
I forgot Spy. Spy's okay.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I'm dragged kicking and screaming to that gentleman's films, and always wind up having a good time.
To Judd Apatow?
No.
Paul Feig.
Paul Feig.
Oh, Paul Feig. Yeah.
That I go and I feel I laugh enough to justify the expenditure.
Sure.
Is it the greatest movie? No.
Sure.
But just like The Heat?
Yeah.
Better than it had any right to be. Yeah. So give him credit for trying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's actually knowing how jokes work in a lot of cases. There's a lot of jokes that land.
Yeah. And then... other than that, maybe... Yeah, I saw Ted 2. That was not as good as Ted 1. I don't think anything else needs to be said about
that. I feel
like
I skipped a lot of the comedies that came out. I mean, I know you ended up reviewing a lot of them. But yeah, I didn't... Ted 2 and Vacation...
The
and...
best thing about Ted 2 is Amanda Seyfried is just glorious.
I saw Get Hard. Was that a summer movie?
No, that was like March or April. Yeah.
I saw that show.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the review.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, we had seen End of the Tour at the Chicago Film Critics thing, mm-hmm. and then Adam had gone to see it again when it hit general release, and you reviewed it. And for the longest time, I was on the fence for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking... like, am I being hoodwinked by something? Especially when I read this review that his wife and his agent and his editor are up in arms because they feel the film represents the beginning of him being merchandised as this thing that he isn't. And the specific sticking point, we've got a minute to discuss this, right?
Sure.
I really love the scene at the end where...
Don't spoil what it is because most people haven't seen it yet.
I'm not sure if this spoiled anything.
Okay.
There's a scene at the end when he's at a church.
Okay.
And I thought it was wonderful for a number of reasons. And according to the Slate article that I read, the filmmakers and the journalist fell victim to a lie that David Foster Wallace told a lot. When he told people that's what he was doing, he was actually at an AA meeting.
Mm.
And then I started to wonder if, again, no biopic is 100% accurate.
Right.
And does it still work as a metaphor of him getting out of his head, which is the only time, I think, in the film that we see him not obsessively ruminating. But in terms of it being a Hollywood film that's basically about two guys talking about things that I think matter and things that I'm interested in, I was blown away by it. But I thought in some weird way that I was being tricked. But it's a good film, right?
Yeah. Well, it's my favorite movie for the whole year so far. And I mean, like, it just kind of reached me in a very personal way. But the thing I really appreciate about it was it shows you that somebody who is brilliant at one thing can be a complete mess at a lot of other things. And that, especially in comparison to somebody who looks up to that person, which the Jesse Eisenberg character looks up to Jason Segel, he doesn't realize that he's probably going to have a better life than David Foster Wallace, even though he's not going to have as much notoriety. And that dynamic is just really interesting, especially in... It's an interviewer-interviewee. It's not a two brothers. It's not two friends. And it's kind of funny because whenever I, for example, like I've only interviewed one person on the site. It was the director of The Rep. And I felt comfortable with that because he was kind of a novice filmmaker. But if I were to ever interview like you did with Tom Holland, I would be very intimidated. And I would be very worried about fan service and being too much of a fan and not being journalistically inclined enough. And I thought that the movie kind of had a really good just relationship to that at the end of the tour, where they were exploring that from a standpoint of how much of David Lipsky is a fan and how much of him is really there to kind of get to the meat of the story, which his editor is always pushing him to do.
And one of the many ironies is that his original piece that Rolling Stone sent him to do never ran.
Yep.
I also thought Jason Segel's performance was sort of amazing.
Yep.
Yeah, it's terrific.
It's a really good movie.
On the other end of the spectrum, Indy, that is my least favorite movie of the year. It's not the worst movie of the year, but it's my least favorite movie of the year.
All right.
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Sure.
Which Patrick saw at the Chicago Film Critics Fest.
As did Adam.
And I avoided it, and I believe you texted me and said that I should not worry about missing it, although it was being trumped. Oh, for only the sixth time ever, it was the audience favorite and the critics favorite. But even watching the trailer, which I saw several times, talk about indie twee.
That's the movie.
The components that one needs to have this year's Juno.
It's interesting because people loved it. A lot of people really loved it. And I think it was really expected to be this year's Juno or this year's Little Miss Sunshine or this year's Whiplash or, mm-hmm. or whatever, to be kind of the indie that really breaks out. And it did not happen.
No.
The movie kind of made no noise when it came out.
Yeah.
Which I was not upset about because I didn't like it.
Yeah, I didn't like it either. It just felt... You said it perfectly. It's just so over directed for the material that they're the story they're trying to tell.
It's to me it feels very dishonest.
But, yeah. Yep.
But you know.
Yeah, because are you talking specifically about they tell you something is going to happen or not happen, and then they do.
That's a big part of it. Yeah, that's a big part of it. But I think it's also a movie that pretends to be about real emotions, but has no connection to real emotions.
Yeah.
Except for, again, the one scene. There's a scene that people talk about where it's all one take. It's this very long take where they kind of argue in a bedroom. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some emotional connection in that scene. At a certain point, I think even the length of the take begins to call attention to itself, as does everything in the movie. So it wants to, kind of Birdman style, impress you with its technique at the same time that it's trying to elicit some sort of emotional response. And I think the two things get in the way of one another. But
is that the shot where there's a bomb in the trunk and the car is going across the next
And then it goes up
border.
Over the and, thing. And then
and you're
Chris
a teacher.
Tucker's in the trunk.
You're a teacher, so I mean like you're around high school students
I'm
a lot.
What?
A t-shirt.
You're a t-shirt.
That's what it sounded like.
Sorry, I talk fast sometimes. And other times
Ryan,
I talk slow.
Ryan is inarticulate.
Because I'm human.
Ryan, sometimes things get so bad.
I feel like you protest too much.
Sometimes things get so bad I want to be a t-shirt, Ryan.
Yeah. Yeah, that Pinocchio journey I went on was really worth it.
I want to be a t-shirt named Ryan.
So what Ryan I was going to say was... The Meet Earl and Dying Girl thing that really drove me crazy was these kids are in high school. They are like into the Criterion Collection type movies. But their way of showing that they love them is to swede them and make fun of them. And when I hear critics be hoodwinked saying this is a movie about movie lovers, I... I think you're a fucking idiot when I hear that.
Well, this is a theme that comes up a lot during some movies that we saw this summer, and I feel like The Wolfpack, which I know is a movie that you had problems with, is the one that kind of does it the best, where it talks about our relationship to art and how some people, the way that they process that relationship is by sort of reenacting it, right? We saw it in Raiders, we see it in Meryl and the Dying Girl, and we see it in The Wolfpack. And I think only in The Wolfpack is it actually saying something about why people do that or the function that that serves. Because, I just felt like, so as movie fans, they make shitty spoofs and, like, and people love them? Why? Yeah. They show them to people and they think they're hilarious. They're just, like, bad puns, poorly made. None of that made any sense to me.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen it because, again, I avoided it.
Did you see The Wolfpack?
Yes. And I don't want to turn the end of this podcast into... to the people listening at home, it would just be sound effects of me punching you in the face. But I love The Wolfpack, and I had big disagreements with your review about, I think what it came down to is the responsibility of the documentarian. And what is happening in The Wolfpack at the beginning is so clearly a very disturbing example of abuse. You felt that the documentarian should have turned the father in some way.
Yeah, I understand that's not the job of a documentarian, but as a human,
again, not a, you protest too much,
not a puppet anymore. I just could not get past that. I just felt like if I were in that person's shoes, which doesn't mean that I'm right and they're wrong, but. I would have to turn the camera off and report it.
But I think what you're talking about is the reason we're watching, because it is such a creepy, unusual situation. But I think a lot of the choices that she made, for instance, we pick up the story. The story begins after changes have already begun to be made. The key moment is when the oldest brother leaves the apartment on his own and walks around. And that's groundbreaking.
In a Michael Myers mask.
In a Michael Myers mask. And later in the film, he's even talking right to the documentarian, looking right at her camera and saying, if you had talked to us a year ago, things would have been really different and we wouldn't have talked to you. And I honestly felt that in some ways... ways that I'm more comfortable with in terms of her being a documentarian, she does do some subtle things in the course of making the film that satisfy what you were crying out for her to do.
Okay.
It's her idea for them to go to the beach.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that beach scene is very, very interesting. And then even more so, she's the one who takes them to the movies. Outside. In fact, we find out during the course of the film what film they've seen.
American Hustle.
I think it's American Hustle.
I thought it was The Fighter. Is it American Hustle?
I think it's American Hustle.
Okay.
And
so really, somebody should have turned her in for that, right? Are we in agreement there?
It's not that bad.
I was very frustrated.
I am a human.
Not a t-shirt. I was very frustrated by the first half hour of the film because I felt she wasn't answering questions that I had.
Yeah.
And... as I watched it, it's one of my favorite movies of the year.
Good.
I began to see that this omission was deliberate on her part because she was deliberately withholding information. In fact, the best example of that I can give, and I'm urging all of you to see The Wolfpack. Even if you have a negative reaction to it, I think you'll be glad that you saw it as a thing. The documentarian spends forever before we actually get to meet the dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought that was deliberate.
Yes.
And a very interesting artistic choice. Also, all documentaries now fade to black, and then there are words on the screen because we get the finale, we get the update, we get the final punch in the gut, and Wolfpack fades, and there's none of that, and I applauded her.
Well, they have that art installation show.
Right. Which, but I mean, you know,
you mean even after that? About. Okay.
Also, speaking of documentaries, Amy got a wide release, probably because it's about music and people like music. And I was sort of put off by it because of its subject matter, which is very dark and sad. But since I saw it, the more I go back to it, the more I'm thinking it's a really, really good film. I had told Patrick at the time I saw it, because we pick up with Amy at the time when camera phones become popular. Mm-hmm. Have either of you saw it?
No.
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Virtually the first 45 minutes is stuff that was captured on the fly with a phone or a camcorder, mm-hmm. and it is the Blair Witch Project. It's impossible to watch. So the minute she hits, and we see the first footage of her on a real television show, it's like, oh, thank God.
Lock it down.
Lock it down. A tragic story, well told. Some of the footage that they have is amazing. The stuff that they had access to. I really recommend it.
Another indie I liked a lot was Love and Mercy.
Yeah.
Right, which we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
And so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Yep.
Although I still feel the Paul Dano stuff overshadows the John Cusack stuff.
I think it's better. Yeah. I think they both work, though.
But I thought that had something to do with the fact that I'm a big Beach Boys fan, and that period in the Beach Boys development is sort of mythologized as this thing that Brian Wilson did, the little symphony in his head, and him saying, I write music so that the music itself makes you feel loved. That whole California dream. I did applaud Cusack for not doing a Brian Wilson impression, because Brian Wilson has several tics now in his personal style that could have been easily carried over. And at first I wondered why he made that decision, because Brian Wilson's very recognizable by the odd way that he speaks. But in terms of the film that we're talking about, it's a brilliant decision, because that would have undermined the whole enterprise.
That movie has one of the best examples of, I always am kind of a stickler for the scenes of musicians creating music, and do they feel false or do they feel real? And the scenes in Love and Mercy, where he's in the studio with the Wrecking Crew, it seems like organically they're building these songs. And I so credit that, because it's not Dr. Dre at the keyboard playing the keys to Nothing But a G Thing, and then Snoop Dogg comes in and has the rap down perfectly. It's
always on the third try. That bugged me too. And when Eazy-E finally gets it on the third, it's like, okay.
Yeah. Well, and he's like not even close. He's like not even close to that the first two tries, and then he gets it. Like
doesn't even have rhythm, and then all of a sudden he's fucking Eazy-E.
It's almost like he's a robot.
I agree.
And what we see, real quick before I forget, what we see in Love and Mercy jibes 100% with what we see in The Wrecking Crew, which is on Netflix right now, and I would also recommend. It's a nice companion piece to Love and Mercy. I'm sorry to know.
No, that's okay. I really loved Love and Mercy. I thought it was so good, and agree that the Paul Dano stuff is better and probably more interesting, maybe just because, again, you're watching somebody create. Mm-hmm. I'm more a fan of that period, whatever, you know. But to the movie's credit, it didn't feel like a case of Julie and Julia, where it's like, oh, half of this is good and half of it you need to get rid of. The Cusack stuff still really works, and I think it still works within the movie. It's not like, hey, they should have gotten rid of that and just made it the Paul Dano show, because I think it all really works together. I really liked that movie.
Because I think what informs the Paul Dano section is that the film is asking serious questions about what creating art does to the artist. And if you look at all the albums that Brian made and all the songs that he wrote, what Cusack is presenting us with is basically this husk.
Right.
And that's fascinating too.
Yeah, and Elizabeth Banks was really, really good in it. And you don't see her in dramatic performances too often, and I thought she just did a killer job.
Yeah, she was really good.
Really good.
Tangerine, did either of you see Tangerine?
I haven't yet. I've been meaning to.
It's good.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say about that. I liked Digging for Fire more than both of you. I don't love it.
I want to see it again.
I think it's worth
it. That's at the Music Box right now.
Yeah, it's just now in kind of wider release. I think it's worth seeing. Anything else we need to mention?
I'll just mention a few indies that I saw that I liked. We don't really have to go into them, though.
I'll give my review in sound effects.
Results?
Ding!
Raiders I thought was fine. Unexpected?
Ding!
People, Places, and Things.
Ding.
I just saw that last night and really loved it.
Charming. On iTunes and VOD now, everyone. Jemaine Clement.
Mm-hmm. Dope. And I'm the last man standing in the Woody Allen fandom, but I liked Irrational Man.
I haven't seen it.
I am so on the fence because it's at the theater by our house it'd be so easy to go over there.
Yeah. The thing that bugs me about Irrational Man, though, is he's hiring younger and younger actresses, and like them trying to put their mouths around Woody Allen's dialogue is just...
I thought that was going to go a different way.
Strange. No. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I didn't see how I set that up. But no, you're hearing like Emma Stone say like, oh, he's just like, he's such a radical and... Thank you for making love to me. It's just like, you would never say that.
You just talked me out of seeing Irrational Man.
You're welcome.
There's a moment in the trailer where...
I haven't seen a trailer even.
Joaquin Phoenix is the Allentar. He has a line delivery that is pure Woody Allen.
Emma Stone is a talented actress who's getting... who's showing up in a lot of shit. Because... Yeah. We didn't really talk about Aloha, and we don't need to, but my God, Aloha.
She plays a quarter Asian or
I
half
have
Asian
a pretty strong, like, worst list, which I don't even like making, but not a good best list, which is weird for the year so far. I mean, I have movies that I really didn't like.
I have a great best list,
yeah,
and very few, because again, Adam steered me away from my doom.
Anything else you want to mention?
Just one.
Okay.
And I've talked about this seemingly endlessly, but maybe just in my mind. Far From the Madding Crowd.
Have not seen it.
Is great. And it was just sort of, what's the old saying? It didn't release. It escaped.
Did you share your weird theory about the summer?
Yeah, I did. But you had started the podcast by saying, could it be this? And I'm just saying.
Oh, the thing about.
That these films...
They're designed to disappear.
To disappear, to make room for the next one. And I find it interesting that we get more and more amusement park rides that are based on movies, but that the movies themselves, like I said, Tomorrowland, seems like a 20-minute film that you see in Disney. That there's this cross-pollinization, and it's not helping the movies, and it's not helping amusement park rides.
Yeah.
So if we're judging this summer based on Inside Out balls, was it a joy ball, a sadness ball... An anger ball or a fear ball? For me, it was a joy ball.
Me too.
I can't go that far.
Lots
I don't
of good
know.
Stuff to see, man.
I
mean,
stuff
look.
I liked. I did see a lot of stuff I liked, so whatever. I probably didn't see that much that I hate, so I don't know why a few movies are leaving a bad enough taste in my mouth that I'm like, fuck summer. But
could it be that the movies were good, but your summer sucked?
Hey, it's possible. I have no idea.
Oh, I forgot to mention... best jump scare that I've had in a movie in a long, long time.
Yeah.
In a movie I didn't think was more than okay, but in Insidious 3, when the girl gets hit by the car.
Oh.
Oh my God.
I thought the window jump was better.
Okay.
In that one. But yeah, the movie was just okay.
Yep.
At this point, they could be speaking Greek.
Anyway.
Put some Windex on.
Thank you guys very much for listening. Happy summer. We're now what, only a month away from Scary Movie Month?
Yeah,
so that's exciting. We have some fun stuff planned, so happy summer. Thank you guys very much for listening. What else, anything?
So I just cut my arm and I'm bleeding, proving that I'm a human.
I know we should have gone out with that, but I forgot to say. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at F This Movie, and you can like us on Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. All of our podcasts, articles, columns that these two heathens write are available at fthismovie.net. Visit us. Check us out. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for listening.
Spoken like a true human.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.